next case before this court is A210761 Glenn Edden of Edinburgh Association versus Hiscox Insurance Company.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is January 11th, 2022, and this is the second of three oral arguments before the panel this morning. As you note, we are hearing this oral via zoom.gov, but the same rules apply here, basically, that are in our physical courtroom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are taping these, and the audio tapes will be made available on our website. So to be clear for everyone, at the beginning of each of your arguments, please introduce yourself. And I don't anticipate technical difficulties, but if there are some, let us know. We'll try and assist in addressing them because we really do want to hear what you have to share with us this morning. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Rob. Thank you all for your time and the opportunity to be heard this morning. My name is Ross Hussey, H-U-S-S-E-Y, and I am appearing here on behalf of appellant Glenn Edden of Edinburgh Association. And the association is here today appealing the district court's dismissal of its action against respondent Hiscox Insurance Company, which the district court did pursuant to Minnesota Rules Civil Procedure 504A, holding that the association failed to file the action in district court within 1 year of commencement. The district court also erred by subsequently failing to grant relief to the association pursuant to Rule 6002A. Your Honors, I am going to go over the facts very briefly in this case because they are important as to how the court may determine what to do here. This is an insurance dispute. The association's property suffered a hail loss on June 11, 2017 and made a claim with its insurer, Hiscox. Hiscox determined that there was damage to the exterior of the buildings, but not with the roofs and shingles and some other components. In 2019, the association learned from a contractor doing some chimney work that the roofs looked pretty bad and like they had suffered hail damage. As a result, the association investigated the loss with the public adjuster, determined there was hail damage to those roofs and made a claim for that damage. This claim was coming up on the 2 year expiration of the policy's limit with which time to commence action against Hiscox. So a complaint was served on Hiscox commencing the action. Hiscox disagreed with the association's assessment that there was additional damage. As a result, there was a dispute the amount of loss. And so the association requested appraisal pursuant to the policy and rule statute 65A01. The parties pursuant to that rule named their appraisers. However, the appraisers could not agree on a neutral umpire. As a result, the association filed an action or filed in district court a motion to appoint the umpire, at which time the complaint was attached as an exhibit to an affidavit to that motion. The court granted that motion granted that motion with an order appointing the umpire on December 4th, 2019. The appointed umpire then set an appraisal hearing date for May 20th, 2020. Prior to that, and on January 30th, 2020, Hiscox filed its answer to the association's complaint with the district court. Prior to the appraisal, about 2 weeks prior to the appraisal, Hiscox appointed a new appraiser. And then asked that the hearing be rescheduled. The hearing was not rescheduled though promptly. And in about July 27th, 2020, Hiscox sent a letter to the association.
Mr. Hussey, if I may, could just given our limited time here.
Yeah.
I mean, I just want to make sure that I'm looking at this case the right way.
Sure.
So looking at rule 5.04A, deadline for filing an action, are you saying that rule is ambiguous? Is that, but what counts as an action and whether like a special proceeding or an answer suffices or it needs to be a complaint? I mean, just help us with the approach this court should take in looking at that. Is that it? And so if you're saying it's ambiguous, why? And if it's ambiguous, then I take it you're saying, but look at this kind of the legislative rulemaking process. I mean, is that cutting to the chase what you're asking this court to do?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. we're saying that Rule 504A does not specify that a complaint must be filed to commence an action in district court.
So no, but my question is more, well, so is, are you saying that's plain on the rule? So we should apply, I mean, we look at rules and as a matter of interpretation, usually the same way we look at statutes. The first question we would ask is it plain on its face or is it ambiguous? Yes, so that's my first question to you. Is it plain? Yes. Are you saying it's plain on its face or are you saying it's ambiguous? So we look to this, to the other evidence.
Your Honor, I'm saying it's ambiguous.
So well, if I could, Mr. Rossi, because page 12 of your brief, you do quote Skyline Materials Limited, which is then defining the term action from Black's Law Dictionary. So usually when we have this battle of definitions, it's because the parties are saying that there's that the rule or the statute is unambiguous. So I think there's an argument that the rule would be unambiguously allowing filing of an answer to satisfy the rule. And I got that from reading your brief because you talk about the definition of action. And when you look at the rule itself, you know, it's written in passive voice, right? It says an action is, any action is filed. It doesn't say the petition or the plaintiff must file an action or, right? So I think there's an argument that it's unambiguous, and I want to make sure I understand what you are arguing so that we approach it correctly. And I agree. I want to hear your answer to Judge Jessen's question. Are you saying that this rule is ambiguous and therefore we look to legislative history, if you will, the task force? Or are you saying it's unambiguous and then in the alternative we can look, if we decide it's ambiguous in the alternative, you're raising a separate argument?
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'm sorry if I have my wires crossed with the ambiguity or non-ambiguity of the rule. My response would be first that it's unambiguous in that it does not specifically require the filing of a complaint with regard to commencement of an action in district court. So in that sense that the rule itself says an action must be filed within 1 year, our response is that happened. The action was filed within district court, a file number was assigned, and therefore that rule was satisfied. In the alternative, if we're going to say that the rule is ambiguous, if we do look at the legislative intent and go to the task force of this, it shows that the task force was anticipating that any party can start an action in district court at any time after the action is commenced. So, and I apologize, Your Honor, because I don't have a great response on the ambiguity question there, but we do believe that based on the plain meaning of the rule, there is no requirement that it be a complaint at this time. And therefore the action itself in this case was filed with the district court within 1 year of commencement when Hiscott either with the motion being filed, seeking relief that was congruent with the relief being sought in the complaint, or subsequently the answer that Hiscott's filed in this report.
I'm gonna say, or Judge Bryant, go ahead. I'll defer.
You should go ahead. I'll follow up with if there's a need. Why don't you go ahead?
So I have a hard time with the with your argument that an action was filed when your motion was filed. I think of it as a separate proceeding, but maybe there's some more precise. I think to have the third arbitrator appointed, I think that was it. Just given that Judge Anderson's order doing that then says, you know, has the let judgment be entered. I mean, it's the finality language, right? So even if it was, even if that triggered the rule, then it was dismissed. So, I mean, I see that as a big distinction between your filing that motion, which yes, there was a court file, but then it was over, and the filing of the answer. I mean, would you agree they're very different actions?
I've thought about that. I don't believe that this was the same action seeking relief that was congruent with what the association was asking for in its complaint. What the association asked for was claiming was that Hiscox breached this contract by failing to pay insurance proceeds. It also asked for declaratory relief if necessary, because appraisal was the proper venue with which to adjudicate the dispute of the value of loss. So by filing the motion in district court, Your Honor, that was part of this action, and that was seeking relief pursuant to the action. And I see that as a little different than a claim where maybe there's a separate legal issue that needed to be addressed in a proceeding, and that was more by itself, but this was congruent with the entirety of the relief being requested. So in that respect, because it had to do with the totality of the case, part of it, I would argue that yes, the action was commenced or was filed in district court within a year at the time of that motion. Also, with regard to whether that the judgment was entered, that issue isn't before the court, and that opens up a whole nother discussion. And I think the question here is, was the action itself filed within the court within a year, and was Rule 504A satisfied at that time? If the court can't get there in the motion, then I would just argue that an answer was filed. And an answer was filed after the order was issued in this case. And that then there at that time, that would trigger the filing of the action pursuant to 504A.
So I think there's a lot of discussion that we could have about the argument that the complaint itself was filed because it was an exhibit at the time you're asking for the neutral. But if I could go back to the impact or implications of a defendant filing an answer and whether or not that might satisfy the definition of the term any action is filed or the phrase in the rule. Does it depend on what is in the answer? In other words, is there a distinction to be made between an answer that just denies everything in the complaint and an answer that has a counterclaim in terms of whether or not that constitutes an action in your mind?
I would say I don't believe it does matter. I think if there is any affirmative relief, then the action is being put forth in the court. But I say in this situation, the action itself, the association seeking relief and commencing the summons complaint against Hiscock, by filing the answer, that matter then was filed. That action was filed within district court. And what I've thought about with this is what would happen in a scenario where, because I know Hiscox raises this, that and says that, well, no scheduling order was issued, no civil cover sheet was issued. Well, what happens if an answer was filed and there was a civil cover sheet and there was a scheduling order and the parties went all the way to the eve of trial and then it was realized, well, wait a second, plaintiff, you neglected to file that complaint within a year. I think everybody would agree, well, we're not going to say that the action wasn't filed within 1 year. We're here, we're at trial, all this happened. So I see it almost as a clerical issue, more so than, you know, that a complaint was neglected to be filed.
I think that kind of pushes us more towards the Rule 60 analysis and the finding factors, but right. The concept that the cover sheet or some scheduling order, that is the telltale sign an action has been filed. I don't know that I see that in the rule at all. So I think I'm one step behind it in terms of what kinds of things can count as an action. Certainly the complaint can. Is there anything else that might count? And if someone's bringing a counterclaim, I would assume that might be a concession that your opposing counsel might make. So in this case, was there a counterclaim filed apart from the declaratory judgment request? Is there a counterclaim filed as part of the answer?
There was no counterclaim filed as part of the answer, but Hiscox did seek affirmative relief in terms of its costs and fees associated with defending this action.
So, Mr. Hussey, if I may, and I will ask Mr. Respondents Council about this as well. So we issued an opinion in 2017, 893 Northwest 2nd, 360, Soga Ha versus Ride Auto. And there's a footnote one, which addresses this issue in a footnote talking about a special term opinion. But if you had a chance to look at that footnote, it does say that interprets this rule as far as the action within 1 year of commitments and says there in a footnote, albeit, that the filing of an amended answer satisfies these requirements. So I'm just hoping both of you will be able to comment upon your interpretation and of that footnote and applicability to our case. And you may not be able to do that till rebuttal, and I understand that.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. What we have found and we have put set forth in our briefing that there are other areas, whether it's in statute or in case law, where courts have found that define what an action is. And they don't necessarily say that an action involves a complaint or summons a complaint. It's a judicial proceeding, which this was. And the judicial proceeding was filed within district court within 1 year with the motion. And then also the judicial proceeding, the answer that stemmed from the complaint was filed within 1 year. So as a result there, and again, we do feel that this is a unique situation and circumstance, and one that's a matter of probably first impression for this court, that a case being dismissed for not being filed within 1 year when the matter, it's undisputed, was in court in some way, shape, or form within 1 year. Same with the answer to that complaint within 1 year.
Well, Mr. Hussey, if I may just ask you to think about one additional question you could perhaps address in rebuttal, since you just stated that you believe this is a matter of first impression. Perhaps you could share with the court whether you think we should issue a precedential opinion in this, if that's the case. With that, you'll have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal. Are there further questions from the panel at this point, Mr. Hussey? Then, Mr. Goodman, we will turn to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chris Goodman, counsel for respondent Hiscox Insurance Company, Incorporated. We're responding to the appeal. We're asking for the affirmance of the 2 issues raised on appeal. The first being the dismissal of the action for failure to file within a year of service, and the second being the denial of the motion to vacate the order dismissing the case. Most of Mr. Hussey's time was devoted to the first issue, and I anticipate that's where I'll spend most of my time as well. So I'll start there. We know that what the rule says. Rule 5.04 says an action must be filed within a year to satisfy the rule. That begs the question of what the word action means. There was a fork in the road, so to speak, raised, I believe, by Judge Bryan. The question being, are we talking about is the position of the appellant that the plain language of Rule 5.04 causes the facts of this case to satisfy the rule? Or does the court need to look at whether it's ambiguous and then turn to the canons of construction? I'm just gonna start with Minnesota Statute 645.45. It defines the word action in the context of a proceeding. We cite in our brief a Minnesota Supreme Court case, Ellis v. Doe, I believe it's from 2019. And it talks about the word proceeding, using the Black's Law Dictionary, is the entire lawsuit, as opposed to a particular action within it. That precedent, that statute, they're relevant here because they instruct us that filing a motion, first of all, to deal with that issue, that isn't filing an action. Second of all, we have to understand the difference between the operation that is accomplished by a complaint as opposed to an answer. Judge Bryan, again, I believe hit this issue with the question, Mr. Hussey as well. And a complaint is a plea for affirmative relief. As the district court in this case observed, an answer in contrast is simply a responsive pleading. It is a response to a action that is commenced by the pleading, the complaint. I understand the distinction Judge Bryan is making, saying, well, what if there is a counterclaim being asserted? And in that sense, then there is an aspect of a responsive pleading that is seeking affirmative relief. My thought on that would be that the court doesn't need to entertain a distinction in that regard because those aren't our facts.
But no, I understand it's a hypothetical question, and I didn't mean to take us into some other useless discussion, right? My main concern with your argument, however, is we have 2 cases, the Shojaga case that Judge Jessen mentioned, and also the more recent MCHS Red Wing case. And I know there are ways to distinguish the questions that were before the court in both, but you have that footnote that says an amended, I believe it was an amended answer counted as far as what is an action under Rule 5.04. And then you have MCHS Red Wing that says for purposes of 5.04, right, the answer counted. Now that was to start the clock, not to satisfy the rule, but an answer counted as far as commencing the suit, filing of an answer So I guess it was service of an answer in that case, right? So service of an answer, because service of the complaint was improper, but service of an answer counted for commencement. And we said for purposes of Rule 5.04, the answer counts in that context. So you have those two cases that make it difficult for us to accept your argument unless we are revisiting that footnote and changing the law, or we are somehow revisiting what we recently said in MCHS Red Wing.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd start with Saraga. I'm just going to call it the Wright Auto case.
Sorchaga, but go ahead.
Sorchaga. Okay. That case didn't appear in the briefing. I didn't know the case existed until Judge Jessen brought it up. I'm frankly not prepared to comment on the case I haven't read. Maybe if the panel wants some briefing on that after the hearing, I can address it. I pulled it up on Google Scholar since we're doing this remotely. I've got that ability sitting at my desk. My comment would be that the statement that Judge Jessen's referring to appears in a footnote that's not central to the opinion, so it's dicta. That's all I can come up with, having just looked at the case about 5 minutes ago. I am, however, prepared to talk about the Red Wing v. Converse case, MCHS decision. Very unique set of facts that don't apply here. Just very briefly, there's service with an acknowledgement by mail. There's an answer to the pleading, but no signature on the acknowledgement. The question for the court was, well, the defendant is aware of the proceeding because they've answered. That confirms the service occurred. But by the letter of the law rules, that service was ineffective. The issue in the Red Wing case is what act, if any, triggered the commencement of the one-year deadline to file the action. So not our issue. And in that case, the court says, well, when the defense answers and the ineffectively served pleading, the date the answer is served, that is the date we're going to use to determine the one-year filing deadline. And the holding in the case is actually bad for the appellant. The holding was that the district court committed error in denying a motion to dismiss for failure to timely commence the action. So factually an opposite, the holding doesn't help the appellant. My two cents, I don't think that case is one that warrants much discussion by the court. The other thing I'd comment on with respect to—
You don't think that the holding, if you will, that filing an answer or serving an answer for purposes of 5.04 was sufficient to commence a lawsuit, that doesn't give any help to us as we're trying to define what an action means?
No, Your Honor, for this reason. If we look at the task force commentary, that comes up on appeal for the first time. We've got a waiver argument in our brief. But let's talk about that. Let's just go down the road of whether the statute's ambiguous. The task force recommended that one-year filing deadline as an amendment to Rule 3 of our Rules of Civil Procedure. And Rule 3 is very clear that you commence an action by service of a summons and complaint. And so in that context, it's clear that the task force is contemplating the action being commenced by the service of those pleadings, and also an action being filed within 1 year, when again, the action means the summons and complaint. The Red Wing case is an outlier with a very unusual set of circumstances that put, frankly, the courts in an interesting box, which is how do we grapple with the fact that by the service of the answer, there was an awareness of the lawsuit, service being a due process consideration. Completely different considerations, again, from the task force report, when we're talking about filing within a year. And that was a balance that the task force recommended be struck between the benefits of hip pocket service and the burdens on the defendant and the court when an action is filed and then court involvement is requested more than 1 year after service. This, of course, being exacerbated, we have a 4 or 6 year statute of limitations on many cases. And so if we're looking at what the task force was talking about when it recommended a 1 year filing deadline, that was originally proposed as an amendment to Rule 3, which says you commence by serving the summons and complaint. I can't comment on the Wright Auto case beyond what I have. But as I mentioned on the Red Wing v. Converse case, very unusual set of circumstances. And the issue there is if you think about it, it's a due process, it's a notice issue. How can we say that the defense wasn't aware that the action had been commenced when they served their answer? And if they're aware the action has been commenced, then how can we say the 1-year deadline to file hasn't also run? A follows B. And so, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If I may, Mr. Goodman. Let me take you back to the question, my first question, Mr. Hussey, which is looking at Rule 5.04A. From your perspective, is it ambiguous so that we even look at this task force language, or is it just plain on its face?
We have page 18 of our brief, footnote 3, and the cases cited there. There are a legion of cases from the appellate courts in the state referring to Rule 5.04A as the complaint file rule. So our position, as courts have consistently interpreted the rule, you satisfy it by filing the complaint. And that is, in fact, the finding the district court relied on. Yes, Your Honor.
Would you agree that other than possibly this footnote that we've been talking about, in a case that I understand you weren't aware of, okay, other than possibly that, there's not been, none of those cases directly address the issue about whether filing an answer suffices to file an action?
I don't know if the cases discussed whether an answer would satisfy the rule. But what we've quoted in the parentheticals after the string citation, Gams v. Houghton from the Minnesota Supreme Court, et cetera, is that the rule is satisfied by filing the complaint. And so there isn't a case out there other than this, what I'm saying is dicta in a footnote in Ride Auto, where any court has said that the filing of an answer satisfies the rule. To the extent, if I'm just anticipating, Your Honor, the thought of yourself or the other members of the panel is, well, this court hasn't had to address that issue yet. And so maybe those prior cases aren't as relevant. Again, your honors, your clerks, anyone involved looking at those cases can see that the context was consistently saying it's a complaint filed rule. To the extent there's some uncertainty about that, again, I go back to the task force originally saying.
Before you get to the task force, which is kind of like our legislative history, let's stick with the plain language of the terms. And I appreciate the cases that refer to the rule as a complaint, right? But the plain language of any action is the plain language of that term, any action, more broad than the plain meaning of the term complaint?
I'll come at it differently, Your Honor, with that question. An answer is not an action, especially when the answer does not include a counterclaim requesting affirmative relief. An answer is saying, given the allegations against us, we're denying, or we have defenses to them if the factual allegations are true. And we have this in our brief, that when you look at action and proceeding and you start looking into the plain language of the statute and not the history behind it or the amendment to 5.04A, what we see is that an action is the event, if I can get my word salad straightened out, is the event that commences an action. An action is a proceeding where a judge or jury is going to resolve a legal issue. When an answer is filed, again, as a district court observed, that's simply a response to those allegations in the absence of a counterclaim asserting some kind of affirmative relief. In this case, for instance, if my client files an answer and says, you know what, based on fraud or some other defense, we want back over $500,000 we've already paid on this claim. That would be different because we have commenced a judicial proceeding to try and get an affirmative relief for our client. The filing of an answer in this case is simply saying those allegations aren't true.
Right, but the service of an answer in MCHS Red Wing, similarly, it's a response, right? I understand what you're saying. There has to be a request and then there's a response. If there's no request, then nothing's before the court, even if the response comes before the court. But we've already said that service of the answer was enough to commence an action. So it seems to me that that word, any action, is not limited to the affirmative request that you would find in a complaint based on the way we've interpreted that rule already.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I believe we have a different reading of MCHS, because the notion that an answer commences an action is not only contrary to what Rule of Civil Procedure 3 says, but we've got very unique circumstances there. When the answer was served, it's kind of like two different meanings of commence an action. When the action was served, that acknowledged, confirmed that the defense was aware that the pleading had been served, even though the service was ineffective. And again, the issue there was, has the one-year filing deadline commenced? And if so, what commenced it? And it wasn't the service of the answer. It was the service of the answer in response to an ineffectively served pleading. Those aren't our facts. Very, very unique set of circumstances threading a needle there. And again, it made sense for the court to say that, because how can we say that the action hasn't been commenced when, although the pleading was ineffectively served, the service of an answer confirms the defendant was aware of the service. And so that put the, as the court said, that put the plaintiff on notice, hey, the one-year clock was ticking. It was error for the district court to not grant the motion to dismiss. I didn't get to the second issue, but I get a sense of what the focus of the panel will be on. I thank the court for your time and ask that it affirm the district court's decision. Under a de novo standard, the law was correctly applied to the undisputed facts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Any further questions from the panel? Then Mr. Hussey, we'll turn to you for the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just following up on Mr. Goodman's last comment, I would respond by saying, how can we say in this case that an action was not filed in district court within a year of commencement when an action was filed in court? Going back to what constitutes an action, it is more broad than just a complaint. And I believe all the cases in the statutes point that way. Whether we're talking about Skyline Materials LTD, in which a judicial proceeding is defined as one that will result in a judgment or a decree, or we're talking about Minnesota Statute 645.45, which defines an action as any proceeding in any court of the state. This is beyond just a complaint. And if you look at Rule 3, 301, where a complaint is specified, that shows that the drafters, they could have said complaint. They could have put that into the rule. Instead, it was action, which is the proceeding. The answer was part of this proceeding, and that was filed. These circumstances are unique too, just like in the Red Wing case. So, and I think the court was correct that these previous cases that discussed the filing of the complaint, in none of those cases was any motion sought, or nor was any answer filed with the court. In this matter, this was filed with the court. Where I want to go with this is, what is the purpose of Rule 504A, a rule that was not in existence, I believe, before 2011. And the purpose of it was to make sure that matters proceed efficiently, costs don't go, that things don't just hang out there. And that didn't happen here, and is not. And that's why when I started this, maybe foolhardily going into the facts, what I wanted to show to the court was that a lot of things were then pushed down the road in this case as more of the result of Hiscox than the association. Whether Hiscox felt it was justified doing those, that's a completely different argument, but that is the case. So really, to not find that this action was commenced and to dismiss this, which courts have held is the most severe sanction you can have, and to not let this be adjudicated on its merits, I think would be a huge injustice for the association and really not congruent with the purpose of the rule and what the rule was meant to accomplish when it was implemented only back in 2011. I will, with the time left, just point out my 6002 arguments, Your Honor. I do understand that abuse of discretion is a very high bar to get to. I will ask that the court do look at the factual circumstances surrounding this and what led to the fact the association was in the position it was in. This is a situation where 6002 is there for a reason. And honestly, I think that the court neglected to look at the prejudice that the association was facing. It did find that Hiscox was actually prejudiced, but didn't say why Hiscox would have been prejudiced. And the facts just didn't align with that. And I don't believe that the court really looked at the purpose of 6002, that it's to grant relief in these types of circumstances. Frankly, if you can't find that there was excusable neglect for the association itself in this, I don't see a case where you really can get there. And the court did not say that the association itself had any bearing on this. And courts, as you've held before, are loath to punish innocent clients for mistakes of their attorneys. So this is a case that, again, it was filed in court within a year of commencement, although the complaint was not as a standalone document, but was in some other form. So the case was filed, and this case should be remanded back to district court so it can be adjudicated on its merits.
Further, any questions from the panel? Does not look that way. So counsel of the court, thanks you for your helpful arguments this morning. We'll take the matter under advisement and an opinion will be issued within 90 days. Thank you very much.
Thank you
all. Thank you, Your Honor.